listeners, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. I'm finding it incredibly difficult to believe Black Friday is just days away. You too? Don't get me wrong, shopping is a hobby near and dear to my heart. But I know my passion is not one shared by all. And let's face it, the aisles of a department store don't always hold the perfect gift for everyone on your list. Books to the rescue! Beginning this week and continuing through the holiday season, I'll be offering up suggestions for those hard to shop for family and friends. My guest today, Tom Schroeder, will be discussing Acid Test, a book that sparked many a conversation. This week, we'll cover nonfiction titles that span diverse interests. Technology, politics, science, history, and entertainment are in today's lineup. So let's get to it as we turn to page one of the book report. Following his blockbuster Steve Jobs biography, Walter Isaacson brings us the fascinating story of the people who created the computer and the internet. The Innovators, how a group of hackers, geniuses, and geeks created the digital revolution, is not only a wonderful history, but also a guide to how innovation really happens. Isaacson begins with Ada Lovelace, Lord Byron's daughter, who pioneered computer programming in the 1840s. He goes on to explore the personalities behind the digital revolution, including Alan Turing, John von Neumann, Doug Engelbart, Robert Noyce, Bill Gates, Steve Wozniak, Steve Jobs, and Larry Page. This is the story of how their minds worked and what made them so inventive. It's also a narrative of how their ability to collaborate and master the art of teamwork made them even more creative. Dennis Boutsikaris narrates.
The internet was originally built to facilitate collaboration. By contrast, personal computers, especially those meant to be used at home, were devised as tools for individual creativity. For more than a decade, beginning in the early 1970s, the development of networks and that of home computers proceeded separately from one another. They finally began coming together in the late 1980s with the advent of modems, online services, and the web. Just as combining the steam engine with ingenious machinery drove the Industrial Revolution, the combination of the computer and distributed networks led to a digital revolution that allowed anyone to create, disseminate, and access any information anywhere. Historians of science are sometimes wary about calling periods of great change revolutions because they prefer to view progress as evolutionary. Quote, "There was no such thing as a scientific revolution, and this is a book about it," is the wry opening sentence of the Harvard professor Stephen Chapin's book on that period. One method that Chapin used to escape his half-joking contradiction is to note how the key players of the period, quote, "vigorously expressed the view," unquote, that they were part of a revolution. Quote, "Our sense of radical change afoot comes substantially from them," unquote. Likewise, most of us today share a sense that the digital advances of the past half century are transforming, perhaps even revolutionizing, the way we live. I can recall the excitement that each new breakthrough engendered. My father and uncles were electrical engineers, and like many of the characters in this book, I grew up with a basement workshop that had circuit boards to be soldered, radios to be opened, tubes to be tested, and boxes of transistors and resistors to be sorted and deployed. As an electronics geek who loved Heathkits and ham radios, WA5 John Thomas Peter was my handle, I can remember when vacuum tubes gave way to transistors. At college, I learned programming using punch cards, and recall when the agony of batch processing was replaced by the ecstasy of hands-on interaction. In the 1980s, I thrilled to the static and screech that modems made when they opened for you the weirdly magical realm of online services and bulletin boards. And in the early 1990s, I helped to run a digital division at Time and Time Warner that launched new web and broadband internet services. As Wordsworth said of the enthusiasts who were present at the beginning of the French Revolution, quote, "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive," unquote. I began work on this book more than a decade ago. It grew out of my fascination with the digital age advances I had witnessed, and also from my biography of Benjamin Franklin, who was an innovator, inventor, publisher, postal service pioneer, and all-around information networker and entrepreneur. I wanted to step away from doing biographies, which tend to emphasize the role of singular individuals, and once again do a book like The Wise Men, which I had co-authored with a colleague about the creative teamwork of six friends who shaped America's Cold War policies.
We've just heard The Innovators by Walter Isaacson. Tom Schroeder has been an award-winning journalist, writer, and editor for more than 30 years. His book editing projects include two New York Times bestsellers. As an editor of the Washington Post magazine and earlier the Miami Herald's Tropic, he conceived and edited two stories which earned Pulitzer Prizes. In addition to being an author and editor of narrative journalism, Schroeder is one of the foremost editors of humor in the country. He has edited humor columns by Dave Barry, Gene Weingarten, and Tony Kornheiser, as well as conceived and launched the internationally syndicated comic strip Cul-de-Sac by Richard Thompson. Today we'll talk to Tom about his latest book, Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal, a fascinating, transformative look at the therapeutic powers of psychedelic drugs, particularly in the treatment of PTSD and the past 50 years of scientific, political, and legal controversy they've ignited. Welcome, Tom, and thanks for being back with us on the Book Report.
It's a real pleasure, Elaine.
In Acid Test, you focus on three men, Rick Doblin, Michael Mithoffer, and Nicholas Blackston. Can you introduce us?
Yeah, Rick Doblin was basically he was a hippie in the 70s, just at the tail end of the era when psychedelic drugs were still not totally banned for research, and he became very enamored with the idea that the therapy of psychedelic drugs that had been used very successfully in the 1950s and 1960s were the future of psychotherapy. Michael Mithoffer was an emergency room doctor who decided that he was sick of only sort of getting to people at the tail end of the pathology, sort of after all the things that they had wrong in their lives resulted in getting a knife in the stomach or a gunshot wound. And he decided he'd rather deal with people on the front end where they developed the bad habits that resulted in that. And also, you know, instead of just doing things to patients like sticking tubes down their throat, he wanted to have a sort of more collaborative type of relationship with them. So he became a psychiatrist. He began to work with post-traumatic stress disorder and to be really dissatisfied with the treatments that were available, which weren't all that effective and for everybody. The third person, Nicholas Blackston, was a 17-year-old kid who joined the Marines just in time for the Iraq War. And in the war, he had these horrific experiences. Sort of every sort of negative thing that could happen happened. And he also had to watch one of his best friends get gut shot and bleed out right in front of him when he couldn't help him. And then he got blown up himself and got physically injured. But the real serious problems were the psychic injuries. And when he got back home, he could not continue with his life. He was so severely affected by post-traumatic stress. And so he really got to the point of suicide. And just when he thought he couldn't go on any longer, he saw a notice that the study that Rick and Michael had come up with was ongoing just 20 miles from his home.
Hmm.
So the climax of the book is really when Nick goes in for his therapy.
Rick Doblin had been described as Timothy Leary for the 80s. Did he ever actually meet Timothy Leary?
Oh, yeah, he did. And he knew, in fact, he knew all the big names in sort of the psychedelic world.
I was fascinated to read that the author Ken Kesey's introduction to LSD had a CIA connection. Can you share that story?
World War II ended. They discovered these German research papers on using mescaline, which is a psychedelic drug, as a interrogation device. And so the Army decided, well, they didn't have any success with it, really. I mean, they were mixed reports. But the Army decided and the CIA decided, well, we're going to try this. So they basically tried to weaponize LSD with no success at all. But they had this far-flung sort of network. They even had a brothel in San Francisco where they would dose the Johns unsuspectingly with LSD and sort of watch what happened. It was horribly damaging and irresponsible. But they also funded all this research, secretly funded all the scientific research at universities. And there was in Menlo Park Hospital, there was a study funded by the CIA that Ken Kesey volunteered for and started taking LSD. And what he really wanted to do was, sort of ride this thing like a wave. And he instituted these things called acid tests, which is, the inspiration for the title of the book, where all these people would get together and the Grateful Dead would play music and everybody would take LSD and just to sort of see what happened. Kesey also wrote the first, he was inspired to write One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is one of the great American novels. While he was under the influence.
We're speaking with Tom Schroeder on the Book Report. So is there any science behind the thinking that continual use of LSD fries your brain?
Well, I mean, I would think that while it's not probably not advisable to like be putting these down like daily vitamins, that actually a lot of research in the 50s and 60s showed that it was a remarkably safe drug, considering how dramatic its psychic effects were, especially when used under the medical supervision in a clinical situation. The real danger of people using it is that they're doing it in an unscreened and sort of unsupervised way, and pre-existing mental disorders do not react well to the LSD experience or to the psychedelic experience, and some people sort of it with pre-existing problems it can sort of provoke a psychotic break. It can create acute anxiety, and in a therapeutic setting, sometimes those moments of acute anxiety under the influence are actually openings for dealing with underlying issues that result in therapeutic breakthroughs. There was just a Johns Hopkins study that used psilocybin to treat people who were heavy smokers who tried multiple times to quit and failed, and they had an 80% success rate, which is more than twice the success rate of the best-known sort of drug-assisted smoking cessation program.
Tell us about MDMA, ecstasy, and the researchers who first determined it could be used in post-traumatic stress therapy.
Well, in the early 70s, just as LSD and other psychedelics were being put on Schedule 1 with heroin and cocaine, a guy named Sasha Shulgin out in California, who was a chemist who had been very impressed by the psychedelic experience and decided that he wanted to dedicate himself to finding similar compounds. And he tested them on himself. And he had a very different kind of psychedelic experience with MDMA than he'd had with other psychedelic drugs, in that it wasn't this sort of pyrotechnic kind of experience with just all this wild sensory input. It was this extremely calm and centered experience. And he recognized that maybe this would be, he knew that, you know, psychedelics were being used therapeutically, and he thought that this might have some special value. So he gave it to a psychiatrist friend of his who had been doing psychedelic therapy for years and was about to retire. And the guy was named Leo Zeff, and he was so impressed with the MDMA's potential that he put off his retirement and basically until he died. And he used it, and not only used it, but sort of advertised its effects, its positive effects, to therapists that he knew all over the country, and hundreds of people were using this in therapy, and they were getting tremendous results. And the advantage of the MDMA, especially for when they were using it for people with traumatic stress issues, was that it really seemed to shut down the whole fear response that drives PTSD. In PTSD, you have a traumatic experience, and you never fully process it, but it kind of lurks in your brain, and it keeps setting off the alarms, if you will.
With an average of 22 vets a day committing suicide, do you think the military will ever investigate the potential of these drugs?
There are as many as 500,000 service people that are returning from our, you know, decade of war in Iraq and Afghanistan with severe PTSD. And for most of them, there is not going to be an effective cure for this. So this is going to linger. I mean, there's still thousands and thousands of Vietnam vets who are still suffering from PTSD. And in fact, the cost of dealing with both the sort of the disability pay and the medical care that we owe our vets over the next 30 years is estimated to be in the neighborhood of $1 trillion. Because of the stigma of psychedelic drugs, because of that whole sort of cultural association with the counterculture in the 60s, the military is kind of returning somewhat of a blind eye to this, and they're certainly not funding it. They haven't spent a dime on this. And, you know, the amount, for a private nonprofit like Rick Doblin runs to fund this research is incredibly hard. It costs tens of millions of dollars. But for the Pentagon, that's pocket change. It's going to take years. The most optimistic estimate before it could be a prescription treatment would be in 2021. And I think that's way overly optimistic. I think it's going to be more like 10 to 15 years. So it really makes me ill that the government and the military establishment, you know, aren't really getting behind this and trying to move this research as quickly as possible.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. Acid test gives all of us so much to think about. Thank you for joining us today.
It was a pleasure, Elaine. Thank you.
Bye. And now let's listen to a sample of Acid Test, performed by Arthur Morey.
Not long after Albert Hofmann became the first human to ingest LSD, Sandoz delivered a cache of the drug they would trademark as Delicid to a Swiss psychiatrist, Werner Stoll, the son of Hofmann's boss, for human testing. The younger Stoll's test subjects would include both healthy volunteers and mental patients. Stoll even took it himself and reported a staggering experience that sounded something like riding a roller coaster through bursting fireworks. He went from euphoria to depression and back several times. At one point he said, "I felt myself one with all romanticists and dreamers, saw the maelstrom of Poe. Often I seemed to stand at the pinnacle of artistic experience. I luxuriated in the colors of the altar of Eisenham, and knew the euphoria and exaltation of an artistic vision." At another, he reported, "I was depressed and thought with interest of the possibility of suicide. With some terror, I apprehended that such thoughts were remarkably familiar to me. It seemed singularly self-evident that a depressed person commits suicide. Here, in spades, was the LSD duality that Hoffman had discovered. In fact, Stoll reportedly told other researchers in personal communications that one of the subjects of his study, given the drug without her knowledge, committed suicide shortly thereafter. The devastating effects of a completely inexplicable psychic disruption were too much for her, one researcher says Stoll told him. If true, no mention of it was made in his formal report on the trial results, which noted primarily the ways in which LSD prompted something like a temporary insanity in the healthy subjects given the drug. He concluded that the new drug might be useful in the study of psychosis, which had proven so resistant to treatment and difficult to understand. As an aside, interesting, considering the potency of his own experience, he suggested that mental health professionals might find it useful to spend a few hours inside the world of the psychotic by taking the drug themselves. The bizarre effects and awesome power of LSD provoked a sensation in the scientific world when Stoll's study was published in 1947. Sandoz sent samples of LSD to psychiatric research institutes, university departments, and individual therapists, asking them if they would be interested in experimenting with the new substance. One of these packages arrived at the School of Medicine of Charles University in Prague, where a 23-year-old medical student named Stanislav Grof was assigned to babysit the study subjects for the 6 to 8 hours during which they would be under the influence. I was fascinated by what I saw and heard and was eager to volunteer for a session myself, Grof wrote of the experience. Unfortunately, to my great dismay, the faculty board decided that students should not be used as experimental subjects. The moment Grof was no longer a student, immediately after graduation, he volunteered for an LSD study. He wasn't disappointed. One thing became immediately apparent. This was no mere temporary insanity. As he recalled in a 1990 Yoga Journal interview, I couldn't believe how much I learned about my psyche in those few hours. The sheer intensity of the array of emotions I felt simply amazed me. I was hit by a radiance that seemed comparable to the epicenter of a nuclear explosion, or perhaps the light of supernatural brilliance said in Oriental scriptures to appear to us at the moment of death. This thunderbolt catapulted me out of my body. First, I lost my awareness of my immediate surroundings, then the psychiatric clinic, then Prague, and finally, the planet. At an inconceivable speed, my consciousness expanded to cosmic dimensions. I experienced the Big Bang, passed through black holes and white holes in the universe, identified with exploding supernovas, and witnessed many other strange phenomena that seemed to be pulsars, quasars, and other amazing cosmic events.
We've just heard Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal by Tom Schroeder. Stephen Johnson explores the history of innovation over centuries by tracing facets of modern life. Things like refrigeration, clocks, and eyeglasses from their creation by hobbyists, amateurs, and entrepreneurs to their unintended historical consequences. Filled with surprising stories of accidental genius and brilliant mistakes, How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World, investigates the secret history behind everyday objects. Johnson examines unprecedented connections between seemingly unrelated fields, how the invention of air conditioning enabled the largest migration of human beings in history, how pendulum clocks helped trigger the Industrial Revolution, and how clean water made it possible to manufacture computer chips. You don't need to be a scientist to be enthralled by How We Got to Now, narrated by George Newbern.
As the robot historians would no doubt remind us, we are indebted to those people every bit as much as, if not more than, we are to the kings and conquerors and magnates of traditional history. But the other reason to write this kind of history is that these innovations have set in motion a much wider array of changes in society than you might reasonably expect. Innovations usually begin life with an attempt to solve a specific problem. But once they get into circulation, they end up triggering other changes that would have been extremely difficult to predict. This is a pattern of change that appears constantly in evolutionary history. Think of the act of pollination. Sometime during the Cretaceous Age, flowers began to evolve colors and scents that signaled the presence of pollen to insects, who simultaneously evolved complex equipment to extract the pollen and, inadvertently, fertilize other flowers with pollen. Over time, the flowers supplemented the pollen with even more energy-rich nectar to lure the insects into the rituals of pollination. Bees and other insects evolved the sensory tools to see and be drawn to flowers, just as the flowers evolved the properties that attract bees. This is a different kind of survival of the fittest, not the usual zero-sum competitive story that we often hear in watered-down versions of Darwinism, but something more symbiotic. The insects and flowers succeed because they, physically, fit well with each other. The technical term for this is coevolution. The importance of this relationship was not lost on Charles Darwin, who followed up the publication of On the Origin of Species with an entire book on orchid pollination. These coevolutionary interactions often lead to transformations in organisms that would seem to have no immediate connection to the original species. The symbiosis between flowering plants and insects that led to the production of nectar ultimately created an opportunity for much larger organisms, the hummingbirds, to extract nectar from plants. Though to do that, they evolved an extremely unusual form of flight mechanics that enabled them to hover alongside the flower in a way that few birds can even come close to doing. Insects can stabilize themselves mid-flight because they have fundamental flexibility to their anatomy that vertebrates lack. Yet, despite the restrictions placed on them by their skeletal structure, hummingbirds evolved a novel way of rotating their wings, giving power to the upstroke as well as the downstroke, enabling them to float mid-air while extracting nectar from a flower. These are the strange leaps that evolution makes constantly. The sexual reproduction strategies of plants end up shaping the design of a hummingbird's wings. Had there been naturalists around to observe the insects first evolving pollination behavior alongside the flowering plants, they would have logically assumed that this strange new ritual had nothing to do with avian life. And yet it ended up precipitating one of the most astonishing physical transformations in the evolutionary history of birds. The history of ideas and innovation unfolds the same way. Johannes Gutenberg's printing press created a surge in demand for spectacles as the new practice of reading made Europeans across the continent suddenly realize that they were farsighted. The market demand for spectacles encouraged a growing number of people to produce and experiment with lenses, which led to the invention of the microscope, which shortly thereafter enabled us to perceive that our bodies were made up of microscopic cells. You wouldn't think that printing technology would have anything to do with the expansion of our vision down to the cellular scale, just as you wouldn't have thought that the evolution of pollen would alter the design of a hummingbird's wing. But that is the way change happens. This may sound at first blush like a variation on the famous butterfly effect from chaos theory, where the flap of a butterfly's wing in California ends up triggering a hurricane in the mid-Atlantic. But in fact, the two are fundamentally different. The extraordinary and unsettling property of the butterfly effect is that it involves a virtually unknowable chain of causality. You can't map the link between the air molecules bouncing around the butterfly and the storm system brewing in the Atlantic. They may be connected because everything is connected on some level, but it is beyond our capacity to parse those connections, or even harder, to predict them in advance.
That was a sampling of How We Got to Now by Stephen Johnson. Napoleon Bonaparte was far more than a military genius and an astute leader of men. Like George Washington and his own hero, Julius Caesar, he was one of the greatest soldier statesmen of all times. Andrew Roberts' Napoleon is the first one-volume biography to take advantage of the recent publication of Napoleon's 33,000 letters, which radically transform our understanding of his character and motivation. At last, we see him as he was, multitasker, decisive, surprisingly willing to forgive his enemies and his errant wife, Josephine. Like Churchill, he understood the strategic importance of telling his own story, and his memoirs, dictated from exile on St. Helena, became the single best-selling book of the 19th century. An award-winning historian, Roberts traveled to 53 of Napoleon's 60 battle sites, discovered crucial new documents in archives, and even made the long trip by boat to St. Helena. Roberts is as acute in his understanding of politics as he is of military history. John Lee narrates.
More books have been written with Napoleon in the title than there have been days since his death in 1821. Admittedly, many have titles like Napoleon's Hemorrhoids and Napoleon's Buttons, but there are several thousand comprehensive, cradle-to-grave biographies, too. Every one of them, published since 1857, relied upon the correspondence that Napoleon III published as a tribute to his uncle. We now know that this was shamefully bowdlerized and distorted for propaganda purposes. Letters that Napoleon never wrote were included, while embarrassing or compromising ones that he did write were passed over. In all, the compendium included only two-thirds of his total output. In one of the great publishing endeavors of the 21st century, the Fondation Napoleon in Paris has, since 2004, been publishing every one of the more than 33,000 letters that Napoleon signed. The culmination of this immense project demands nothing less than a complete re-evaluation of this extraordinary man. Napoleon represented the Enlightenment on horseback. His letters show a charm, humor, and capacity for candid self-appraisal. He could lose his temper, volcanically so on occasion, but usually with some cause. Above all, he was no totalitarian dictator, as many have been eager to suggest. He may have established an unprecedentedly efficient surveillance system, but he had no interest in controlling every aspect of his subjects' lives, nor did he want the lands he conquered to be ruled directly by Frenchmen. He believed that one can control foreign lands only by winning over the population, and sought, accordingly, to present himself in terms that would make him sympathetic to the locals, feigning sympathy for their religion as a means to an end. It is notable that his strategies varied considerably in Italy, Egypt, and Germany. In the one instance where this was not the case, Haiti, he later acknowledged that the brutality of his policies had compromised his effectiveness, and mused with foresight that one could not keep people subject for long at a great distance. Above all, he hoped to modernize Europe. "They seek to destroy the revolution by attacking my person," he said after the failure of the royalist assassination plot of 1804. "I will defend it, for I am the revolution." His characteristic egotism aside, Napoleon was right. He personified the best parts of the French Revolution, the ones that have survived and infused European life ever since. Although the Terror had finished 5 years before he grabbed power, the Jacobins were a powerful force who could always return. Similarly, a royalist restoration which would have wiped away the benefits of the revolution was also possible. Instead, the 15-year rule of Napoleon saved the best aspects of the revolution, discarded the worst, and ensured that even when the Bourbons were restored, they could not return to the Ancien Régime. The ideas that underpin our modern world—meritocracy, equality before the law, property rights, religious toleration, modern secular education, sound finances, and so on, were championed, consolidated, codified, and geographically extended by Napoleon. To them he added rational and efficient local administration, an end to rural banditry, the encouragement of science and the arts, the abolition of feudalism, and the greatest codification of laws since the fall of the Roman Empire. At the same time, he dispensed with the absurd revolutionary calendar of 10-day weeks, the theology of the cult of the supreme being, the corruption and cronyism of the directory, and the hyperinflation that had characterized the dying days of the Republic.
We've just heard Napoleon, A Life by Andrew Roberts. The results of the recent midterm elections make this book more timely than ever. The Stranger, Barack Obama in the White House, is a nuanced, behind-the-scenes narrative of President Obama's White House tenure. It's written and performed by Chuck Todd, NBC's chief White House correspondent. Barack Obama won the 2008 presidency partly because he was a Washington outsider. But once sworn in, that distinction turned out to be double-edged. While he'd been a brilliant campaign politician, working inside the system as president turned out to be much more of a challenge than Obama ever imagined. Todd draws upon his unprecedented inner circle sources to create a gripping account of Obama's tumultuous White House years. He illuminates what Obamaism really is, what the president stands for, and how his decisions have changed and will change American politics for generations.
But Obama's rise also came at a moment when the cynical media that had covered all those flawed candidates was changing dramatically. The thirst for someone different, especially among a new partisan media, gave Obama the candidate exposure even in 2004 when he first came to national prominence, when he could be contrasted with the stiff and stale Kerry. The rise of YouTube and social media gave the candidate unfettered access to the activists and voters he was trying to reach. And Obama received fawning coverage, which drove opponents from Hillary Clinton to John McCain to Mitt Romney crazy at times, due in no small part to the baby boomers who ran America's newsrooms, all of whom had grown up during the civil rights era, and many of whom were drawn to the notion of America's first black president, even as they all feared the worst. Like several of his recent predecessors, the president came to office with a clear mandate to change the city and its governing institutions. Unlike his recent predecessors, he was fairly new to national politics, a factor that aided him with a public desperate to change the way Washington works, but has served as a severe handicap as he's attempted to govern. Not since Jimmy Carter's election in 1976 had voters been so angry that the outsider they had sent to the Oval Office was so inexperienced. In many ways, the country's anger and cynicism in 2008 mirrored 1976. Instead of Vietnam fatigue, it was Iraq, and instead of Watergate, it was polarization that was frustrating Americans and making them lose faith in government in general. Voters were tired of Washington, tired of politics as usual, so they sent a relative political stranger to Washington, someone who hadn't even served a full term in the United States Senate. Obama had never held executive office or an executive position in anything larger than his own campaign, and he had been the first non-governor or non-vice president to win the presidency in nearly two generations. It appears that Obama had never even fired anyone of consequence before becoming president. That's how little executive experience he brought to office. To understand a legacy, one must understand the man behind the legacy. And despite two national campaigns, an insatiable media machine that measures its news cycle in minutes rather than days, and as much reporting as any president has ever received, Barack Obama the man remains shrouded in the carefully maintained image cultivated over his entire career. While there's no ordinary path to the White House, Obama's is more extraordinary than most. Most of what we knew about his childhood and his psyche in 2008 came thanks to his own memoir, Dreams of My Father. And while it may be hard for most Americans to relate to a guy born in Hawaii to a white mother and a black Kenyan father, there has always been something about his unusual upbringing that explains many of his best and worst personality traits. Despite being born in Hawaii, he was not raised as a child of privilege. He saw his share of poverty while living in Indonesia as a child. And when he was sent back to stay with his grandmother in Hawaii as he became a teenager, home was an unremarkable apartment building in Honolulu, which could easily be mistaken for some nondescript medical office building that houses a handful of doctors. It was not exactly how many Americans dream of life for their own children, let alone in a supposed paradise. No big backyard, no tree-lined streets with kids playing ball. It's hard to picture the eventual plaque that will go up on that Honolulu apartment building to note its historical importance. It's certainly no log cabin. Like many Americans, the president's unusual upbringing shaped him to be the person he is today. He is a very present father for his two daughters, the opposite of what he experienced. He's extremely self-reliant, perhaps to a fault, But that self-reliance has also served him well as an ambitious politician.
We've just heard The Stranger, Barack Obama in the White House, by Chuck Todd. In All the Truth Is Out, the week politics went tabloid, Matt Bai, former chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, revisits the Gary Hart affair and looks at how it changed the intersection of American media and politics. In 1987, Gary Hart, articulate, dashing, refreshingly progressive, seemed to be a shoo-in for the Democratic nomination for president. And then, rumors of marital infidelity surface, comboed with that infamous photo of Hart and Donna Rice snapped near the yacht, Monkey Business. Suddenly, it all came crashing down in a blaze of flashbulbs, the birth of the 24-hour news cycles, tabloid speculation, and late-night farce. Bai shows how the Hart affair marked a crucial turning point in the ethos of political media and pinpointed the moment when candidates' character began to draw more fixation than their political experience. Bai offers a poignant, highly original, and newsmaking reappraisal of Hart's fall from grace and his overlooked political legacy. Rob Shapiro narrates.
When I announced for president in 1987, we did it right up there, Hart said, pointing toward a rock formation at the top of the hill. He had a strange mannerism, which some of his longtime acolytes still liked to ape good-naturedly, in which he would raise his bushy eyebrows several times in quick succession before making some wry observation. Flicker, 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 the eyebrows went. Those reporters looked like they were going to drop, he said in his Kansas-bred twang. I tried to imagine the podium set against the red rocks and blue sky, the crush of cameras and the palpable sense of history. Hart's aides had wanted him to do something more conventional, with a ballroom and streamers and all of that, but he had insisted on standing alone against the mountainous backdrop, near the amphitheater he had called a symbol of what a benevolent government can do. Pledging to run a campaign of ideas, he had added in words that later seemed ominous, "Since we are running for the highest and most important office in the land, all of us must try to hold ourselves to the very highest possible standards of integrity and ethics, and soundness of judgment and ideas, of policies, of imagination, and vision for the future." Standing amid that outcropping, Hart had been as close to a lock for the nomination, and likely the presidency, as any challenger of the modern era. According to Gallup, the leading polling firm of the day, Hart had a double-digit lead over the rest of the potential Democratic field. The second and third most popular choices, Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca and New York Governor Mario Cuomo, weren't even running. In a preview of the general election against the presumed Republican nominee, Vice President George H.W. Bush, Hart was polling over 50% among registered voters and beating Bush by 13 points, with only 11% saying they were undecided. In its annual survey that winter, Gallup found that President Ronald Reagan was the most admired man in America, followed by Pope John Paul II. In third place, along with civil rights leader Jesse Jackson and just above Bush, was Gary Hart. He would have been very hard to stop. "Must have been a hell of a backdrop," I said. Hart said nothing further, and after an awkward moment, I let it drop. We took a quick tour of the amphitheater, and then Hart led me back onto the road. Here the mountain pass serpentined for miles as it climbed to 7,000 feet above sea level, with nothing but rock facings and fir trees for long stretches of the ride. I flipped on the radio in my rented four-wheeler and hit the seek button until I landed on the public radio station one can almost always find in such places, nestled near the low end of the dial. The American media at that moment was obsessed with the case of Mark Sanford, South Carolina's governor, and a guy who had been considered a likely Republican presidential candidate until his life had recently unraveled on national television. Sanford, who had been quite the moralizer during the scandal over Bill Clinton's affair with an intern years earlier, had apparently been carrying on his own long extramarital affair with an Argentinian woman, which came to light when he disappeared from the state for several days, apparently because he had fallen deeply in love and lost all sense of time or self-preservation. Now, on Planet Money, a reporter was talking to a behavioral economist named Tim Harford, an Oxford professor who had apparently decided it was worth his time to apply his skills to the phenomenon of adultery. According to Harford, illicit relationships were the function of a simple cost-benefit equation. People stayed in them when the benefits outweighed the costs and got out of them when the reverse was true. After Harford went on about this theory at some length, the interviewer, in the studiously understated tone of public radio reporters everywhere, asked him a question. Why, if this business about costs and benefits were true, didn't politicians ever seem to learn from their mistakes? Why cheat on your wife when you know that the cost to your career ambitions would very likely be catastrophic?
We've just heard All the Truth is Out by Matt Pye. As you know, if you're reading the paper, controversy is something Lena Dunham does not shy away from. Not That Kind of Girl, A Young Woman Tells You What She's Learned, confirms Dunham as one of the most original writers working today. To quote the author who performs the book, "If I can take what I've learned in this life and make one treacherous relationship or degrading job easier for you, perhaps even preventing you from becoming temporarily vegan, then every misstep of mine will have been worthwhile." This book contains stories about wonderful nights with terrible boys and terrible days with wonderful friends. No, I am not a sexpert, a psychologist, or a registered dietitian. I am not a married mother of three or the owner of a successful hosiery franchise. But I am a girl with a keen interest in self-actualization, sending hopeful dispatches from the front lines of that struggle.
Some days my haul is massive. A peach power suit with subtle coffee stains, leggings with trompe-l'oeil chains running down the sides, a pair of boots specially made for someone with legs of different lengths. But some days the spread is meager. The usual bounty of patterned off-brand keds and ripped negligees has been snapped up. On one such day, I wander over to the book section, where people discard their guides to better divorce and crafting how-tos, sometimes even their scrapbooks and family photo albums. I scan the dusty shelf, which looks like the book collection of an unhappy and maybe even illiterate family. I ignore get-rich-quick advice, stop briefly at Miss Piggy's autobiography, contemplate a book called Sisters, The Gift of Love. When I reach a faded paperback with edges so yellow they have almost gone green, I stop. Having It All by Helen Gurley Brown, who graces her own cover, leaning against her tidy desk in the kind of shoulder-padded plum suit I have taken to wearing ironically. All pearls and knowing smile. I spend the 65 cents required to take the book home. In the car, I show it to my friends like it's a decorative joke, something for my shelf of kitschy trophies and Sears photo studio shots of strangers' kids. This is our hobby, appropriating meaningful artifacts and displaying them as evidence of who we will never be. But I know I'm going to devour this book, and when I get home, I head straight to bed, shivering under my patchwork quilt, an Ohio snowstorm swirling in the parking lot outside my window. The book is from 1982, and on the inside cover is an inscription written in ballpoint pen. "To Betty. Love, Margaret. Your OptiFast friend." Smiley face. This moves me. The idea that the book was handed from one woman to another in some long-ago weight loss support group. I extend her message in my mind. "Betty, we can do it. We are doing it. Let this book take you to the stars and beyond." I race home from class every day for a week to devour Helen's teachings. I'm electrified by the way that, in Having It All, Gurley Brown shares her assorted humiliations and occasional triumphs and explains, with idiot's guide precision, how you too can be blessed with love, success, sex, money, even if you're starting with nothing. Most of her advice, it should be noted, is absolutely bananas. She encourages readers to eat fewer than 1,000 calories a day. Crashing is okay, so is fasting. Satisfied is out of the question. You have to feel slightly uncomfortable and hungry during your weight loss, or it probably isn't happening. The more sex you have, the more you can tolerate. Helen has little tolerance for free will in this department. Exhaustion, preoccupation with a problem, menstrual cramps, Nothing is a good excuse for not making love, unless you happen to be so angry with the man in your bed, your eyes are darting around their sockets and your teeth are grinding. Some of her advice is a little more reasonable. Always leave for the airport 15 minutes earlier than you could. It will save your valves wearing out. Or, if you have severe personal problems, then I think you go to a shrink for advice and support. I can no more imagine not going to get your hurting head and heart taken care of than one would go around the streets with blood spurting out of your throat. But her frank wisdom loses some of its power because it's forced to occupy the same space as gems such as, to me, avoiding married men totally when you're single would be like passing up first aid in a Tijuana hospital when you're bleeding to death because you prefer an immaculate American hospital some unreachable distance across the border. Having it all is divided into sections, each section a journey into some usually sacrosanct aspect of feminine life, such as diet, sex, or the intricacies of marriage. But despite her demented theories, which jibe not even a little bit with my distinctly feminist upbringing, I appreciate the way Helen shares her own embarrassing, acne-ridden history in an attempt to say, look, happiness and satisfaction can happen to anyone. In the process, she reveals her own unique pathos. A passage about binge-eating baklava stands out in my mind. But maybe I underestimated her. Maybe that is not an accident, but is, in fact, her gift.
We've just heard Not That Kind of Girl by Lena Dunham. Readers, the holiday season can be a roller coaster ride. But in addition to solving some of your gift-giving dilemmas, Stolen Moments with a Great Book provides the peace and solitude you may be needing to relax and re-energize. You can find some great book suggestions on my website, bookreportradio.com. Wishing you a very happy Thanksgiving, filled with a memorable meal and cherished moments with family and friends. I know the holidays are a busy time, but don't forget to join me in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.